From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A 34-year-old anti-war documentary is getting its first major theatrical release this week. The film Winter Soldier documents an event in 1971 in which Vietnam veterans told the press about atrocities they had witnessed or participated in. The event was organized by Vietnam veterans against the war. On today's Fresh Air, we meet former Marine pilot Rusty Sachs, one of the vets featured in the film. Also, part two of our interview with singer and songwriter Paul Anka. He'll tell us how he came to write the lyrics to Sinatra's signature song, My Way, and the theme to The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1971, the group Vietnam Veterans Against the War brought together about 125 vets to discuss war crimes they had witnessed or participated in. It was an attempt to tell the public that the My Lai massacre, which had just been reported, was not the only war crime Americans were responsible for. The larger goal was to end the war. The event, which was called the Winter Soldier Investigation, was held at Howard Johnson's motel in Detroit. The press was invited, and a team of documentary filmmakers recorded it. But the film Winter Soldier was hardly shown in America outside of college campuses. Now it's been re-released and will open Friday at the Lincoln Center Film Society in New York and soon show in several other cities. The Winter Soldier investigation was part of a series of events, including protests, memorial ceremonies, and an event in which many vets, including John Kerry, threw their medals or ribbons over a fence to symbolize their objections to the war. It was John Kerry who asked my guest, Rusty Sachs, to participate in the Winter Soldier investigation. Kerry had read a letter to the editor Sachs had written in opposition to the war. Sachs had served in Vietnam as a Marine helicopter pilot in 1966 and 67 and rose to the rank of captain. He's now executive director of the National Association of Flight Instructors. He's one of the vets featured in the documentary. In the film of Winter Soldier, during your discussion of what you witnessed and what you did in Vietnam, you describe witnessing fellow Marines throwing bodies out of helicopters. Would you describe what it is that you witnessed?
Yes, and let me state up front, because there is a very common misunderstanding because of events that have taken place since then, that I was talking about throwing people out of helicopters while they were flying at altitude. I was describing unloading prisoners after we had landed. Prisoners who had been blindfolded and were being unloaded by crewmen, taking them and just throwing them out the helicopter onto the ground in front of the helicopter, or beside the helicopter. On some occasions, they made a game of it. Well, we can get one further than that. And they'd throw another one. It was two Marines, and they'd rather than walk a fellow out of the helicopter, they would just swing him and let him fall to the ground outside the door of the helicopter. And then the next guy, they would just swing a little harder so it would land either further away or not on top of the guy. It was the troubling thing was that it was being done in such a cavalier fashion. There wasn't anything special being attached to it by the people who were doing it. And it wasn't treated as out of the ordinary by those of us who were standing watching.
Well, if I remember correctly, in your discussion during the Winter Soldier event, you said that you thought this had basically become standard operating procedure because there were officers around when it happened and nobody protested. Nobody said anything.
Right.
Nobody tried to stop it.
Nobody tried to stop it. And I can't speak for other people who didn't try to stop it, but I still carry within me the guilt of not having done anything to stop it. First time I saw this happen, and I saw it happen, several times, I was real new in country. I was just learning the ropes. I was learning, what village is where and what altitudes are safe to fly at and what routes are safe to take and basically how you behave in combat. And when I first got there, everybody there was senior to me. They might have not have been senior in rank, but everybody was there. Everybody there was senior to me in terms of experience. And I think it's inevitable that the new guy on the block scopes out what's going on and tries to fit in rather than try to change everything immediately. And I have had sleepless nights for years, just kicking myself for not having said anything at a time when I should have.
And was Winter Soldier kind of a way to make up for that, a way to say the things you wish you'd said when they were happening?
Oh, yeah. And I think all of us, to some extent, felt that this was an act of atonement. It was some sort of penance. Was admitting to our shortcomings in hopes that others would not fall short in the same manner. But the basic goal was to tell people that this sort of stuff was going on in Vietnam. It was not a clean war. It was not, to the extent that there can be such a thing as a clean war.
In 1971, at the Winter Soldier event, you heard other Vietnam veterans testify that they had witnessed horrible atrocities, including a Vietnamese woman being gutted after being killed, rapes with all kinds of horrible implements. Did you believe everything that you heard?
I tried to maintain a degree of skepticism, but when I saw the faces of the people telling these stories, I knew that these were events that actually took place.
Did you enlist in the military? Did you support the war when you entered it? And if so, what was the turning point for you when you started to oppose the war?
Well, when I enlisted in the Marine Corps, there wasn't much of a war going on. People were talking a little bit about the unrest in Laos, but there wasn't a war in Vietnam when I enlisted. There were American troops there, but nobody would use the word war to describe what was going on there. I enlisted with the absolute intent of becoming a helicopter pilot. And the war just sort of happened to build up and take birth during the time I was going through training. And by the time I got my wings in 1966, we all knew that we'd be going to Vietnam. I mean, there was no question. Every pilot would be going to Vietnam, and we were looking forward to it. We were going to get to practice what we'd been taught. So I got over there and I was excited, and I couldn't wait. How naive we can be, to Ms. Gross. I couldn't wait to be there and find out what it was like to be shot at. My opposition to the war came about late in my tour, when my friend Craig was killed. He was a fellow from New England, who had gone through training with me. We were in the same pre-flight class. We flew together in our primary training and in our basic training and our advanced training, and then we were stationed in the Camp Lejeune complex, and he got killed. Now, he wasn't the first friend to get killed by any means, but for some reason, it upset me more. It was a straw that broke the camel's back, because I'd seen enough friends and peers get killed, and I had seen no change in the way the war was being conducted, or the way our day-to-day activities were changing. They weren't changing. There wasn't any progress being made, and I said, this is just wrong. We made a big mistake here, and we've got to stop it. We've got to do something to stop the war.
My guest is Rusty Sachs. He's featured in the 1971 documentary Winter Soldier, which is being re-released this Friday. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is Rusty Sachs, a former Marine captain who served in Vietnam. He's one of the vets featured in the 1971 documentary Winter Soldier. The film is being re-released this week. The Winter Soldier event, in which Vietnam veterans who had started to oppose the war testified about atrocities that they saw or participated in, that was just one event that was part of a series of events in which Vietnam veterans against the war and other veterans sympathetic to their cause protested the war. Among those events was an event, if we could call it that, in which a lot of veterans, yourself included, John Kerry included, threw their medals or ribbons or military papers or other military-related objects and threw them over a wall to protest the war. We heard a lot about that during the presidential campaign in 2004. You know, the meaning of John Kerry doing that was endlessly debated. Whether he threw over medals or ribbons and what the difference was endlessly debated. What did you throw over that wall?
I no longer had my medals because I had given them away earlier.
To
who? Actually, to the set of the Boston production of the American tribal love rock musical Hair.
What did they use them for?
I'm not sure. I think they probably hung them on a flat, you know, on the stage someplace. But I had my ribbons. I threw my ribbons. The park police or someone had erected a high wire fence across the steps to the Capitol on the mall side, and we couldn't go beyond that fence. But the vets lined up pretty much single file along the fence. And this fellow made a speech, and then people were coming up to the microphone, and people would individually speak a few words, and then throw whatever they were throwing, medals or ribbons, or one fellow threw a cane, others threw discharge papers over the fence. And as I was, two or three back in the line, somebody came up and handed me two medals and said, "Here, these are for you." And I didn't know. I looked at them and I recognized them. One was a Distinguished Flying Cross and one was a Silver Star. And now I was almost at the microphone and I had these two decorations that I had never earned. And I was, I had in the space of about 15 seconds, I had the most rapid moral crisis I've ever had in my life. Well, what do I do with these? And I recalled two friends who had gotten killed recently, both in senseless accidents, not as a result of direct enemy action. One had gone down in the water with his helicopter, got out of the helicopter, was treading water, and someone tried to hoist him out of the helicopter by hovering above him so low that he drowned in the downwash of the rotor blades. And the other had been steered by radar vectors to a landing zone in terribly bad weather, and something messed up and he flew into the side of the hill and got killed. I had a Silver Star in one hand and I had a Distinguished Flying Cross in the other hand. And I got up to the microphone and I said, "For Captain Roger P. Harrell, United States Marine Corps, this is a Silver Star. And for Major Bob Kramer, U.S. Marine Corps, this is a Distinguished Flying Cross." And there's an interesting sequel to that, if I can go on a little further.
Sure.
Years later, probably 20 years later, there was a documentary that had that little snippet extracted and broadcast. I came home from work, and my wife handed me the telephone and says, "It's for you." Picked up the phone, and a voice said, "Is this Mr. Sachs?" And yes. "Were you the guy who was on TV last night?" I said, "Yes." He said, did you say something about a Major Kramer? I said, yes. Bob Kramer was in my squadron. He was a major and I was a lieutenant, but, you know, we knew each other, and he was one of the people we lost. There's a long pause, and he says, that was my wife's father.
Wow.
And she's always wanted to be able to talk to somebody who knew her father overseas. And I wonder if it would be okay if I had her call you tonight, or I'll call you and just put her on the phone with you, and she can talk. And it was a very warm conversation. I met her face-to-face within about a year at a reunion. And it was, there was a moment of healing that took place because of that little 15-second crisis I had trying to figure out what to do with somebody else's medals that somebody had given me, somebody had handed to me.
Let's get back to that moral crisis. What were you planning to throw over the fence before you were handed the medals?
Oh, I had all my ribbons that were mounted, and I had them in my hand, and I threw them over. So that's what I was going to throw.
What does it say to you that you were given medals? Does that take away from the authenticity of the event? I mean, I've seen that footage, because that footage is in Going Upriver, which is a documentary about John Kerry and his participation in these anti-war events in 1971. And so I've seen that footage of you, and I just assumed, as I'm sure everybody watching it does, that it was your medals.
Mm-hmm.
Does it change anything? Does it make it less real, more staged?
That's what caused the moral crisis. So what do I do with these? I can't fly under false colors, but I've got them in my hand. How can I use these to make a message that might help end the war a little bit more? I didn't claim that they were mine. I named the people who had been awarded those decorations, whom we had lost, and tried to make some memory of them.
Were other people given medals to throw over too?
I don't know. After I threw mine and threw my batch of ribbons, I was nervous. I was shaking. This was a tremendous atonement. This was a very powerful emotional moment for each of us. I walked down the steps and away, and I came upon a vet in a wheelchair who was there, observing, and we just sort of hugged and wept there from the tremendous emotion of having divested of ourselves of this, of these little colored cloth pieces that symbolized so much, and we had to use to divorce ourselves from what they were for.
What was it like for you during the 2004 election to watch the Winter Soldier testimonies, John Kerry's testimony before the Senate Committee on Foreign Affairs, the protest in which you and Kerry and other veterans opposed to the war threw medals and ribbons over this fence? What was it like to see, for you, to watch all those actions become headlines again and to become very controversial, with people from on different sides telling the story and the meaning of the story in completely different ways?
It was very frustrating to me to see John Kerry, a man I absolutely admired, for his conduct both during and after Vietnam, vilified by folks who basically opposed his values rather than his actions. That was very painful, and it was very frustrating to see John responding in a very mild fashion and not using the eloquence that he had used so effectively as a 28-year-old kid many years ago.
It's been a really long time. 23 years, I think, since you actually saw the whole film Winter Soldier. Do you plan on going to see it?
I've been invited to go to Lincoln Center on Friday. I plan to be there. I got a hunch I won't sit through the entire film.
Why not?
It's very discomforting to see young men in such pain over having done things that they did. I lived through that in the 70s. I don't really need to be reminded. And Terry, to extend it maybe longer than you'd like, I really understand now why my father, who had been in the army in the Second World War and had been at Normandy and gone through the Battle of the Bulge and stuff, refused to go see Saving Private Ryan. I just don't need to see that again.
Well, thank you very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Rusty Sachs is one of the vets featured in the 1971 documentary Winter Soldier. He's now the executive director of the National Association of Flight Instructors. Winter Soldier is being re-released, starting with its showing Friday at the Lincoln Center Film Society. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor Audio Courses, including masterpieces of Western music, classics from the Baroque to the modern. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, part two of our interview with Paul Anka. He'll talk about writing the Tonight Show theme for Johnny Carson and writing My Way for Sinatra. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to listen to the second part of our interview with songwriter and singer Paul Anka. Earlier this week, he talked about being a teen idol in the late 50s and early 60s, writing most of his hit songs like Diana, You Are My Destiny, Put Your Head on My Shoulder, and Puppy Love. Part two was about his life after the teen idol era, when he wrote the song that became Frank Sinatra's anthem, My Way, and at Johnny Carson's request, wrote the theme for The Tonight Show. But before we hear that, let's hear another track from Anka's new CD, Rock Swings, which features his swing versions of rock songs from the 80s and 90s by bands like Nirvana, REM, the Pet Shop Boys, and Van Halen. Here's the original version of Van Halen's Jump.
How you feel. You got to roll with the
That's Van Halen. Here's Paul Anka from his CD Rock Swings.
I get up, and nothing ever gets me down. You got it tough. Huh, I've seen the toughest around. And I know, baby, just how you feel. You gotta roll with the punches to get what's real. Oh, can't you see me standing here? I got my back against the record machine. I ain't the worst that you've seen. Can't you see what I mean? Might as well jump.
Jump.
Might as well jump.
Jump.
Go ahead, jump.
Jump.
Go ahead and jump.
Jump.
Hey, babe, how you been?
Now, you grew up in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
You're of Lebanese descent. And mm-hmm. when you were becoming known in the 50s, I think Lebanon probably wasn't on the map for a lot of people. Do you know what I mean? They probably... Mm-hmm. So, and most of the pop idols in the States, they were Italian, they were Jewish. Their families had been here for a long time. They were African American. Probably weren't a lot of Lebanese pop idols back then.
None.
So, how did you handle your background when it came to publicity? Is it something that you talked about much?
Well, it was what it was. I was first Canadian, brought up a Canadian, so my whole sense was, you know, Canadian upbringing. I had an awareness of my Lebanese background, not a large community, certainly not equatable to Italian, and you know, that was pretty much most singers were Italian. You know,
right.
I was just
and so many of the listeners want to know, is like, oh, is he Italian like I am? Is she Jewish like I am?
Right.
You know, like, how much do I identify with them?
Right. I think everybody thought I was Jewish or Italian.
Right.
Then it came out in the PR, you know, he's a Canadian of Lebanese descent, and that's what it was. You know, I never really played that up. It certainly, at some points, people went, oh, you're not Italian. Then I really confused them. I really confused them by moving to Italy in the 60s because I just loved Italy, and I loved the culture. And I, when I left my record company and I bought all my masters, I went to RCA Victor and started a company with them. And I said, I want to go to Italy and record in Italian. I just have so much in common with that country. And I went over there and I started this company in Rome. And I started recording in Italian. And I had like a ton of hits. I was selling millions of records. My name over there was like one word, Polanka. Polanka. I check in a hotel, it was under P, Polanka. And I was winning these festivals. I had the greatest time of my life, and I only recorded in Italian, only wrote in Italian with Italian writers, and it was one of the greatest times of my life. So that totally confused everybody.
What point did you start thinking about how you were going to make the transition to adult music? And again, just to go back to the 50s and early 60s, it's a time when a lot of adults in the record industry were thinking rock and roll is this like passing phase, and it's not going to last, and a lot of like young rock and rollers are being groomed to play the copa because they were going to become adults soon and they had to make that transition to the adult audience. So what did you think your life would be like as an adult, and what kind of transition did you think you would have to make?
Well, somewhere around 58, 59, you know, I realized that, you know, I was changing and I had to change. I was looking for longevity. And, you know, one has to realize that back then, rock as we know it today, or when it really started in let's say, the mid-60s, and, you know, you had the Beatles with that form of rock and roll, which was light in 64. Prior to that, there was nothing else around except the Rat Pack. So it was all Frank Sinatra, that kind of music, and oops, who are these little kids with this kind of music that no one liked, including Sinatra. You know, we started saying to ourselves, well, where do we go from here? I mean, you know, look at those guys. They're so cool. I mean, they work that place, Las Vegas and the Copa. And, you know, we want to be like them. And I'd sit with Bobby Darin. And, you know, he and I had that natural instinct to go that way. And we'd say, we want to be like them. And, you know, I recall one of my earlier albums was called Swings for Young Lovers. And it was an album of all old standards with a big swing band, which was very unusual. And then Darin did his. And, you know, I realized that that's where I wanted to go if I had to survive. And, you know, with my management and agents, all of a sudden I was the youngest kid to work the Copa. Then I was the youngest kid to work Vegas in 59 with Sophie Tucker. And I started to say, yeah, you know what? I think I can survive if I learn my craft and I become a performer. And that's what I pursued. And I really started to sense the foundation broadening, which was going to allow me to maybe sustain myself, because I felt that people were looking at me different, not only as the writer, but this performer and this kid that put this tux on. And then Darin became successful with Mack the Knife. So it really looked like we were on the right course. And then we started to merge with Sinatra. And there I was working with them and learning from them and being around these guys. And that was the final goal for us. And then the Beatles came and changed everything.
When you started hanging out with Sinatra and the other guys in the Rat Pack, what were some of the things about their lives that you wanted to emulate and other things about their lives that you wanted to make sure to avoid?
Yeah, for sure. You know, you're enamored and flattered being around them and being accepted by them. You certainly weren't one of them, but you were on the periphery but also allowed in. And you know, you like their sense of style. You like the way they dressed. You certainly liked the music. You liked the way that they sang. You liked the way they performed. For a while, you know, you started getting the habits of, they teach you how to play blackjack. Okay, if you don't lose a lot of money. You watch them drink and smoke. You know, life is choices. And I looked and saw what it did to them and saw how they suffered from it. And went, you know what, I'm not going to be the smoker and I'm just not going to drink the hard liquor because I need to function. I want to be in control of what I'm doing. So you learn, you know, both sides of that, what to do and what not to do. But it was very exciting to be around. It was a big learning college for me.
Did Sinatra treat you like the kid?
Yeah, I was the kid. You know, everybody, we all had our robes in this famous steam room that we all hung out in. And Dino was the Dague. Joy Bishop had a robe, which was one of his sayings, like, you know, what do you think about that? I forget what it was. Sammy was Smokey the Bear, and mine was the Kid, and that's what Frank called me, the Kid.
And did that seem affectionate to you, or did you feel like you wanted to grow up and not be the Kid anymore?
No, I was I was the Kid. I was younger. He was very affectionate about it. I liked it. You know, I called him the old man, ultimately. You know, you got with the program. I never felt in any way inferior. I was certainly younger. You know, I was just sitting there watching this incredible candy store unfold in front of me, from JFK showing up and Marilyn Monroe and all these stars and, you know, all the activity and all the little boy antics.
My guest is Paul Anka. His latest CD is called Rock Swings. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the second part of our interview with songwriter and singer Paul Anka. You know, we were talking about your friendship with Sinatra and some of the things that you learned from him. You wrote the English lyric for the song that became his anthem, My Way. The song pre-existed, but it was a French song with a French lyric, a lyric that was totally different from your English lyric. Mm-hmm. How did you first hear the song, and what made you want to write a new lyric for it?
Well, as I said earlier, I was very much into the whole European culture, and I started spending a lot of time in Europe. I'd gotten married there in Paris and brought my children every year to the south of France to a house that I had down there that we rented. And I was down in Mougins, which is just a little village south of France, and I was listening to the radio, and not unlike Rock Swings, you know, listening to all of these, you know, modern songs and knowing where they fit, I heard this melody on the radio, and I said, there's something more to that. I'd like to get my hands on it. So I called a friend of mine in Paris who I was in business with a publishing company, and he said, yeah, I know the guy that has the song, and it's, you know, it's not that big a hit, but what do you want? I said, just give it to me, the rights. He said, fine. He said, I'll call the guy. So I flew up to Paris, and I met with him, and they gave it to me. I mean, there was no money changed hands.
There was no money?
Nothing. There was no work buying the pyramids, nothing. It was real simple, couple of pages, a piece of paper, and I took this song. I just took it from that form, and I started playing it on the piano into the vibe that I heard. And it was just more classical and structured, and fade out. Fade in. I'm in Florida. Sinatra calls, and he said, let's have dinner. I'm doing this movie down here, but let's have dinner tonight. I'll come and see your show. We have dinner. He said, kid, I'm doing one more album with Costin. I'm quitting the business. I'm fed up. I'm getting out. And, you know, he'd been really hassled. Things were going on in his life that he didn't like, and he wanted to quit. So that really moved me. You know, one more album. I'm out of the business. Sinatra, can't believe it. I go back to New York, where I was living at the time, and I started typing, and I said, now, if Sinatra were writing this, you know, not unlike Anka writing something in Rock Swings, what would he say? And I started, and now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain, da-da. And it started to write itself. And I called he and Don Costa, who at the time were out at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, and I said, guys, I've got something for the album, and I just, you need to hear this. And about a few months later, I got a call, knowing that they were in the studio, and Sinatra was on the phone, and he was in L.A., I'm in New York. He said, kid, listen to this. And he put the phone up to the speaker, and that was the first time that I heard Frank Sinatra singing My Way. And I just started to cry. It was just the most emotional moment for me, because I'd never really written anything like that, let alone have Frank Sinatra be the messenger of such you know, a different song in what was going on back then in the late 60s.
Well, why don't we hear Frank Sinatra singing My Way with a lyric by my guest, Paul Anka.
Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do, saw it through. Without exemption, I planned each charted course, each careful step along the byway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Yes, there were times, I'm sure you knew, when I bit off more than I could chew. But through it all, when there was doubt, I ate it up and spit it out. I faced it all, and I tall, and did it my way. I love.
That's Frank Sinatra, and the English lyric for My Way was written by my guest Paul Anka. His new CD, Rock Swings, features his new swing versions of rock songs from the 80s and 90s. You know, you show up in so many different aspects of popular culture. You wrote the Tonight Show theme.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how did you get to do that?
Well, you know, a lot of my business is, it all starts with that phone call. and you know, you get phone calls. And this one call, well, let me take you back. It was a call saying I needed some comedy element on a show I was doing in Great Britain for Granada TV, and I needed comedy. And someone called and said, look at this guy, he's funny. And they sent me a film of this guy called Johnny Carson. And I looked at it, and it was this guy, Johnny Carson, who was had a morning show for kids. The only problem was that all night he drank, and he showed up with a hangover. And the kids are screaming and yelling, and that didn't fit. So I thought it was a very funny bit, and it was. And I brought him over, and he did the show. We got to know each other a little bit. I came back to New York after that and ran into him and his manager somewhere in a building. And they said, you know, we're thinking of doing this show for a couple of years, the Tonight Show, and we want to change this and want to change that. And I think maybe we need, and do you want to write something? And, you know, yeah, does the Pope pray? I'm a writer. So I went and I did a demo for about $1,200 of what I heard and put it down, da-da-da-da-da, just very simple. And I sent it to him, and I got word back, another phone call saying, you know, you got it. I mean, there was certainly a little wedge in there in that the original band leader, Skitch Henderson, wasn't pleased because he wanted it to be his. And what I did at that point was when I heard that there was some jeopardy, I said, Johnny, take half the song. You can have half the writing and half the publishing. And that just ensured me staying on the air. What I thought would be 3 years, which turned into you know how many and the longest running TV theme in the history of television.
For listeners just tuning in, my guest is Paul Anka, and his new CD, Rock Swings, features his swing interpretations of rock songs from the 80s and 90s. One more thing in the annals of Paul Anka lore, and this is a website that you probably really hate. I'm sure you know about it. There's a website called The Guys Get Shirts that features...
Oh, yeah, I love it. It's great.
It features a really long tirade where you're bawling out your band. This was recorded a few years ago, probably surreptitiously.
15 years ago by a real snake that we fired after a month that brought a tape machine in. In fact, we had a nice big moment on it with Howard Stern recently.
Oh, did he play it?
Oh, yeah, he played it, and he listened. He absolutely agreed with it. And he said, look, I've done that. I do that. And everybody does, you know. I mean, I think that any guy running a company gets it. The whole point of that tape, you know, I'm a real stickler for detail, and I have a real strong respectability and responsibility to my audience. And when I'm up on that stage... and anything that I do, it's got to be as perfect as possible for the consumer, for whomever. You know, I don't go to work at night and take the check and run. So what was happening there was a lot of mistakes in the band in the sense that we'd rehearsed it one way, and then when you have a cutoff or you're doing something, everyone has to end together. And the other was that we'd gone, spent a lot of money on getting guys dressed so that there was uniformity, and whether it was for the TV show or whatever it was. And guys just dropped the ball. You know, a lot of musicians, some of them are drinkers and some of them are doing dope and what have you, and you learn that, you know, later in the gig. It's like hiring people. You know, the resumes are one thing and everybody's on their best behavior, but until you get somewhere into the voyage and realize that, you know, you've got some bad apples in there, that's when you have to deal with it. And, yeah, it's a funny tape. You know, listen, that's me, and... I'm that way, you know. People don't toe the line; they're out.
Well, you really lay into the band on this, and you say things. When I effing move, I slice like an effing hammer. And
right.
What's it like to really bawl out your band, and then be in front of them in a performance? Because when it comes time to perform, you want that band to be really sympathetic, and you want them to play in a moving way. So,
they do. They don't even take light of it. We're having dinner together on Saturday night. It's totally meaningless because they're used to that environment. They've done it with Buddy Rich. They've heard it with Sinatra. You know, these are seasoned guys that really, when you show them those mistakes and you ball them out any way you want, they know the personality and the other side of the person. I mean, I've heard, Tommy Lasorda. I mean, there's like thousands of these tapes out there from Orson Welles to Lasorda. And I think we're all indoctrinated with that and get it. So a band... when you're giving them work, and most of those guys are still with me today, you know, they know the personality, they know when they're wrong, they know how to decipher and edit what all of that is, and it really doesn't come to play whatsoever. I mean, when you're doing this 47 years and you're successful on that stage, every entity is working and all the energies are working. And the other side of the coin is, you know, you're the guy that's loaning the money, that you're doing this for their families, that you're bringing them here. So you got to look at the full mosaic. This is not anything new here. This is a small pebble on the whole infrastructure of business where people hear it. I know how to motivate people and how to treat them, and I've been doing that for years, so I have absolutely no regrets for anything on that whatsoever.
My guest is Paul Anka. His latest CD is called Rock Swings. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with songwriter and singer Paul Anka. You know, when songs are as popular as yours, you never know where and how they will be used. And in a moment, I'd like to ask you to tell us the most unusual place you've heard your song performed or the most unusual way you've heard one of your songs performed. But first, I want to read you a paragraph from an article in the Seattle Times from January 1987. You probably already know about this, but here it goes. President Corazon Aquino's forces used tear gas and Paul Anka records today in a vain bid to get 150 soldiers loyal to ousted strongman Ferdinand Marcos to vacate a TV station they've held since yesterday.
It was the front page of The Economist.
Okay. About 1,000 troops wearing gas masks were deployed around Channel 7, and about 7 tear gas canisters were fired. Hours before the tear gas assault began, troops played Paul Anka songs over a loudspeaker for the rebels, saying they might enjoy some beautiful music.
Right. That was in the editorial piece of The Economist. Yeah, that was, I've been to the Philippines many times. I go to Asia quite a bit. Your songs are used, obviously, in many different places. I've experienced a myriad of emotions from how they were used. I think the one that really jolted me the most was that, you know, My Way being as important a song for me, coming off of all those adolescent songs, someone called me and said, we're sending you a recording by Sid Vicious and the Sex Pistols. And I said, yeah, okay. And they sent it, and it was My Way. In fact, I dare you to play it when I'm finished.
Oh, I love that version of My Way. You like it, don't you?
Oh, I do like it, absolutely. But they sent back then, you know, it was jolting. I guess it's the other side of the coin somewhat of Anka doing these rock songs for Rock Swings when you think about it. In terms of the strategy and the philosophy, I think he had a right to do it. And once I got past it and realized that he was very sincere and that the song meant something to him, that's when I okayed the license. And that's kind of an interesting case in point. You know, I've seen different artists do them differently, and I've respected the fact that they brought to the table what they were capable of doing with any of my songs and allowed it.
So getting back to this Ferdinand Marcos thing, were they using your records to try to drive...
to calm them down.
To calm them down or to drive them out?
I couldn't understand.
Uh-huh, okay.
Yeah, they were... I think the Economists, what they were saying was that... you know, after implementing everything else that they were doing, they felt that my music was going to, you know, I mean, my music was very popular in Asia. You know, there were times where I had 5 records in the top 10 in Japan or Manila. So that there was, and they, like Europe, take American music a lot differently and deeper. So I think the point of the article was that this music, after everything else, was going to just calm them down a little bit so that they can continue to negotiate with them.
Did it work?
Thank you. Well, there they are today. Yeah, I think it did work.
Do you get royalties when your record is used that way?
I would say no.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
It goes into a collective. I don't think somebody's running around with a sheet in the midst of a war and attack.
ASCAP doesn't show up.
Please sign this.
Paul Anka, his new CD is called Rock Swings. Here's the aforementioned Sid Vicious singing My Way.
One more time,
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Today is gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you. By now, you should have somehow realized what you got to do. I don't believe that anybody feels the way I do about you now. And all the roads we have to walk are winding, and all the lights that lead us there are blinding. And there are many things that I'd like to say to you, I don't know how.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Lucifer Shadow, a novel of passion and danger set in Venice by David Hewson, author of The Villa of Mysteries. And from TIAA Cref, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the author of the novel The Kite Runner, which has been on the bestseller list nearly 50 weeks. It's based in part on the experiences of the author, Khaled Husseini. Husseini grew up in Afghanistan before the Soviet invasion. His father was a diplomat, and the family was granted political asylum in America. Join us for the next Fresh Air.